Good morning, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to This Irish American Life, coming to you from Glucksman Ireland House, NYU Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. My name is Dr. Miriam Nighan Gray, and I will be your host on Saturdays from 9 a.m. to 10 a.m. Eastern Standard Time. You can tune in to us on WNYE 91.5 FM in the Tri-State area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA, care of Mr. Adrian Flannelly. So whether you're here in New York City, or in Ireland, or somewhere else further afield, sit back, relax, agus fáiltis teach. For those of you who don't already know, Glucksman Ireland House is NYU's Centre for Irish and Irish American Studies. Inspired by the vision and philanthropy of Lewis L. Glucksman and Loretta Brennan Glucksman, Glucksman Ireland House, NYU has evolved into a vibrant and world-renowned centre for the study of Ireland, Irish America, and the global Irish since its founding in 1993. We're coming to you today from our home, which is an elegant townhouse at Washington Mews and Fifth Avenue in New York City's Greenwich Village. Well, folks, here at Glucksman Ireland House, we're actually busily getting ready for our annual fundraising gala, which takes place on Thursday, February 28th. We are honouring Alice McDermott and Jim Rooney. Alice will be awarded the Seamus Heaney Award for Arts and Letters, and Jim Rooney of the Pittsburgh family, Pittsburgh Steelers fame, will be awarded the Lewis L. Glucksman Award for Leadership. We're really delighted to be honouring such great honorees and to be welcoming Mary Heaney, Seamus's widow, and of course a great poet and writer in her own regard, who will come from Ireland to present the award to Alice, and our own Loretta Brennan Glucksman will present the award in Lou's honour to Jim Rooney. So we're really excited about what has turned into a really great annual event for us. This is actually our 7th year doing it. It's a lot of work, but a lot of fun, so we're looking forward to that. On this week's show, folks, I'm delighted to share with you an interview with Sergio Kiernan. Sergio is, as I will introduce him, a journalist based in Argentina, but you've guessed it, folks, with a last name like Kiernan, there is some Irish in there, and Sergio very generously is going to sit down and chat to us about his experience as an Irish Argentinian. It's always great to have an opportunity to expand our horizons as to the Irish experience in the Americas writ large. So we're delighted to welcome Sergio to the show. Following on from that, I'm going to have a chat with Bridget Bray. You know Bridget, I spoke to her in October last about her genealogy events, and she's continuing some really great work in that regard. So Bridget is going to come on to talk to us about some events that she has planned for March 2nd and 9th, and the topics of both, I think, will be of immense interest to you all. So enjoy this, folks. First of all, we'll hand over to Sergio. I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life, and indeed to Glucksman Ireland House here at New York University, Sergio Kiernan. Sergio is here by way of Buenos Aires. He is a journalist. He is the Sunday editor of Pagina 12, the Sunday newspaper in Buenos Aires, and he's involved in the Society for Irish Studies, which you might tell us a little bit about, Sergio, as well. First of all, welcome to Glucksman Ireland House. Are we marking your first visits to Ireland House on your trip here at the moment, or had you been here before?
No, I haven't. Indeed, this is my first visit.
Oh, wow.
House,
oh,
and
right.
I'm very pleased to be here because I've seen it 100 times in other visits to New York, and I always wonder. So now,
good, I'm good.
The dream come true.
Excellent. Well, we're absolutely delighted to have you here, and for you to take some time during what is a vacation to talk to us. I suppose, Sergio, when I say a name like
Sergio Kiernan, the first thing that many of our listeners will think of, well, Kiernan sounds like a very Irish name, and you clearly speak fluent English, etc., etc. Can we maybe start at the beginning, as it were, for at least some of your descendants, in terms of telling us a little bit about, I suppose, reflecting on the Irish experience in Argentina through the lens of your family's history?
Sure. Well, not all the Irish emigrated to the British Empire or the United States, which, of course, was the overwhelming majority of the emigration, came here or to Australia, Canada, New Zealand, or Britain itself, which is a story we all know. But several thousand, tens of thousands, went to Argentina starting in the 1850s. Especially from Longford and Westmead, where my family is from. And the reason was, there were some Irish there, even from before our independence. You know, the flight of the earls and then the flying geese, the main destination were France and Spain. Mm-hmm. So many of those Irish noblemen and warriors and soldiers were then given charge of cities, towns, or military outposts in the empire. So many came to the Americas as Spanish officials and officers, many of them. That's why you have figures like Bernard O'Higgins being the liberator and the founding father of Chile. He was the son of an Irishman who became a very prominent colonial official in Peru. And Bernardo was born in Chile, and he became a patriot and the leader of Chilean independence from the Spanish. So there was already a strong connection. But in the early 19th century, with Argentina already an independent country, what happened is there was a group of Irish from Westmead, basically, that moved to Argentina and did very, very well. So they started, they were like 10 people, but the most prominent were two brothers who started a real emigration agency on their own. They started this propaganda effort, writing letters, writing to the local papers, trying to get the Irish to come to Argentina and telling them basically, there is another country to go to. This is a Catholic country. There is no discrimination against the Irish, and in 5 years you're a full citizen. And most important, they pay your labor with land, which was, as we know, very tempting for the Irish at the time. So my great grandfather, who was born in Mullingar, County Westmead, in 1848, and his younger brother, Patrick, they went to Argentina. They landed there in 1868 when they were 20 and 18. Their family did have some land, but, you know, it was a big family, so the younger brothers will never get any land. So they did what most of the Irish did at the time. They took jobs at the time where was the Indian frontier. So the army was pushing the tribes south into Patagonia and opening new land in the Pampas for settlement and colonization. You could get a land grant, but after 5 years you had to show improvements. You had to build some kind of habitation, you had to fence some part of the land, and so on and so forth. As well, they were introducing marinas, and in Argentina there is no tradition of shepherding, so they were bringing Irish and Basques to take care of this new industry. And the deal was this is family lore. Mm-hmm. My ancestor Michael and his brother Patrick, they were hired as shepherds. They were given, say, 200 heads of sheep, and after 3 years, they could keep one-fourth of the new lambs. If they give you 200, and then after 3 years you had 400, 50 were yours. Plus, a plot of land. So my great-grandfather did that for 20 years until he had, you know, his holding. He had his land, he had his sheep, he built a house, and then being 40, he decided it was time to marry. So he went down to Buenos Aires for one of the two yearly markets that were very popular at the time.
How long, far of a distance, Sergio, would that have been approximately, just to give us an idea?
Well, he settled in a place called Suipacha, which is about 60 miles north of Buenos Aires.
So it's not that far.
Not that far, no. Good land. It's a very Irish community to this day. If you go there, it's a small town, but it's very funny because you drive into it, you go to the main plaza, and there is the church. The church is St. Patrick's in Suipacha. The priests are Palatines. I remember going there once, and I find this youngish priest baptizing this child in the most atrocious Spanish you ever heard, with this wide Western brogue. It was unbelievable. But no problem, because we all know what the priest is saying, mm-hmm. right? I mean, we don't really need to understand the words. So, very successful. And this was a young priest coming from, I don't remember exactly a county, but he was on the shore of the Atlantic, and he had one of those accents. Mm-hmm. Young man, very enthusiastic. Now, that place, if you go to the cemetery, it's all Irish names. Mm-hmm. The main avenue is called Irish Immigrants, and the main street you will find the hardware store, it's called Murphy's.
Wow.
So very Irish community to this day.
So the main street is called
Irish Immigrants, in honor of the Irish community.
Wow.
So it's
so
it's
that's where Michael Kiernan
settled. So at 40 he takes the train or brings down his sheep, because the idea was twice a year you would bring your wool or your animals to the city, to the big markets, sell them. And the Irish padres in town, especially, this was started by a great man called Anthony Fahey. Father Fahey created the Irish community in Argentina. He was a very active man. And one tradition that he created was, as they had these big markets, he would have an Irish ball to try to match these farmers who were single with the girls coming into town from Ireland, and actually matchmaking. So that's how my great-grandfather, born in Mullingar, met his wife, born in Ballymahon, Longford, which is a 10-minute car drive away. But they met in Buenos Aires, got married, moved to the farm, and started a family. They had 8 children.
Do you know what her name was, Sergio?
Yes, Anne Quinnan. We're not sure about the spelling. In some papers, it's Q-U. In others, it's a K. So it can be either Quinnan or Keenan. We don't know.
Okay. So that was your great-grandmother.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Who was a spinster at 26.
So when her husband then was 14 years older than her.
Exactly.
And so Irish women presumably then were following that immigrant path as well to Argentina.
Yes. There were more men than women, and many men married locals. There's a very funny, in a way, tradition in Argentina of people having Irish and Basque names, which is it fascinated Borges, the writer, until he realized that it came traditional because they were colleagues and neighbors. They would do the same shepherding, and you know, people who were very much alike in a way, and they were just neighbors. So the kids intermarried. So you have people. By the way, that's my background too. I'm Irish and Basque. Mm-hmm. My father married a woman of Basque descent.
Mm-hmm.
So it became even, you know, some of these Irish and Basque Irish made made fortunes. So some of the grandee names in Argentina are names like Brady Villalonga, which sound really strange, but you know, in Argentina, in Spanish, that would sound even fancy, like one of your old Dutch names here. So my grandfather was the second youngest kid, Michael,
of that family of eight.
And one of the very few to marry and have children. It's strange that the first generation, many didn't have children or never married. But my grandfather did, and here I am.
And so where did he stay in that place, or did he move to Buenos Aires?
No, they moved to Buenos Aires. When their father died, they sold the land and moved to Buenos Aires. And they used something that at the time, and I'm talking about the years right before the First War or during the First War, they were bilingual. So I remember my grandfather, his first job in the city, he was 17, and he went to work for the English railroads. And the railroads in Argentina were created by British companies. So there were openings always for people who could speak English. And he lasted 1 year because he hated how the Brits treated him. Seems that, you know, that was the one place where he was a mick. So he moved to an American company, and he worked for them, a cement company, the Lone Star Cement Corporation, people from Texas. And he loved it there. He started as a clerk, and he died the president for South America.
Wow. So what was his name, Sergio?
Michael J. Kiernan.
Oh, he was Michael as well.
Mm-hmm.
So as far back as you can remember, Sergio, this family history was just your background.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. But you see, when I was a kid, I'm 60 now. When I was young or a child, being Irish was not as nice as it is today, you know. What happens to me now is I travel anywhere when they ask me, what kind of a name is Kieran? I say, Irish. Oh, great. It's like, whoa, fun, pops, nice things, the Celtic tiger and all that. Now, when I was a child, the only thing people knew about Ireland were the Troubles. So if they associated Irish with anything, it was with the IRA. So now I'm, you know, it's like a better deal for my kids. It's good to be Irish. When I was a kid, it was just, you know, one more immigrant community in an immigrant country. Argentina is like the U.S. It's a country created by immigrants.
Mm-hmm. Sergio, so from a young age you learned about this family history, presumably, but it seems that you've, you know, engaged intellectually and in terms of writing very much with topics to do with Ireland as well. Can you tell me a little bit about the genesis of that engagement with Ireland, you know, and the history of Ireland, and say, for example, your interest and involvement in the Society for Irish Studies, etc., etc.?
Well, I was handed down a tradition. At my grandfather's place, there was, over the fireplace, there was, as far back as I can remember, there was a copy of the Declaration of the Republic, which I very much memorized at a tender age. You know, in a pinch, I think I can recite it today. And this thing about, okay, you are an Argentine, of course, this is your country, you speak Spanish, fine, you do your duty by this country, but remember, you're Irish. Some years ago, I had this wonderful conversation with this South African gentleman. I was in Cape Town, and very, very, very smart person. So he asked me, he was very interested about how we go about life being from Argentina and having Irish names, or for that matter, being an American with a German name. Now, how comes, you know, my nationality is Argentine, my name is Irish. For an African, that's not very common, actually. People, there isn't that much emigration or immigration in African countries. So I explained to him, you know, well, my ancestors left Ireland, went to Argentina, and here I am. You know, 150 years later, I'm an Argentine, but I have an Irish name, and we keep a tradition. So he looked at me and said, okay, I get it. So your nationality is Argentine, and your tribe is Irish, which I loved as a concept. I find it very useful. So, of course, you have your passport, your citizenship, your country, plus your tribe,
mm-hmm.
that you can carry around and pass down to future generations. Now, there is a moment when you start thinking about, okay, what's your identity? You are an Argentine, but you're an Irish Argentine, not the same as being an Italian Argentine or a Syrian Argentine or whatever. And you start reading up your history and your politics and noticing certain things, like Che Guevara was Irish too, and he never ever conceived politics in a quote unquote normal, relaxed, moderate way. He had this very Irish, very 19th century Irish attitude, all or nothing. His idea of self-sacrifice, martyrdom even, when he goes to Bolivia and everybody tells him it's not going to work, you're going to die in Bolivia, he writes a farewell letter saying he'll try to start a revolution to save Bolivia, or at least give an example to the ages. That's a very Irish thing to say. That sounds like the patriots in 1916. There are a bunch of other figures in politics in Argentina that come up with this attitude. It's very funny. It's like the Irish settle in Argentina, they stay away completely from politics. You will find very, very few Irish names in politics, say, in late 19th century, early 20th century. We never had anything remotely like Tammany Hall. No prominent Irish politicians. Maybe a mayor here, a mayor there, something small and local. That's it. Until the 50s, when a new generation comes into politics, these guys do feel Argentine. They want to get involved. They do. But most of them, or many of them, have this irredentist attitude, this pulsion. And the 50s and 60s were very political for all of us, basically, for Argentina as well. So you have groups that come talking about revolution and organizing, where, say, of six people that actually run that group, four are Irish. There's a famous group called Taquara, which is the name for a lens, and the four people who ran it were Joe Baxter, Joe Nell, and the Walsh brothers. And then two guys with the typical Italian names, which was like to make it normal. The four of them spoke perfect English. They were bilingual. They were second generation Argentine. And famously, they would meet at a bar, have a drink, and have political arguments in English, so the police couldn't understand what they were saying. And they were famous, they became famous basically because in 1961 they carried out the largest bank heist in the history of the country. They robbed a whole chunk of money, millions and millions and millions, and that commando coup was carried out by the four Irish in the group.
Wow.
So if you read the history of that group, it's almost comedic. They say, no, wait a minute, this is the IRA in the 50s or 60s. Can be Buenos Aires, Argentina, and all these Irish. Then you have the tragic figure of Rodolfo Walsh, the writer, who wrote about the Irish community, all this very strong fiction about the Irish in Argentina. He was first generation. His father was an Irish immigrant who managed land and ranches for other people. A very remote and cold man that made Rodolfo's life miserable. He became a writer, and both his daughters became Montoneros guerrillas. He became a Montonero guerrilla. He was killed. His eldest daughter was killed. Only the youngest survived, Victoria Walsh, who is now a senator in Argentina, a left-wing senator. That family was destroyed by the military. But to give you an idea, Walsh carried a gun all over the place at all times. And when he saw police coming for him, he shot a cop in the leg, and he was shot dead. A few weeks before that, his daughter, his eldest daughter, had been surrounded in a house by the military. There was a terrific shootout, and when they realized that they had lost this engagement, that they were going to be captured and probably horribly tortured and murdered, they climbed to the roof, the Walsh girl, and I say girl advisedly, she was 24, and her boyfriend, they stood on the roof, showed their guns, put them to the head, and they yelled, "You don't kill us, we do it." And they shot themselves there. So this, okay, the 70s were very crazy. And you had these extremist groups, these very violent guerrilla groups, and this horrible repression that befell the country with the 1976 coup. But the Walsh, the family, all these people, were, they went an inch further. They had something that I feel akin. My father was Rodolfo Walsh's almost exact contemporary. My father never became a guerrilla, but he had the very same attitude towards politics. You know, you don't go and vote. You don't reform things. You change them. You need a revolution. You have to go for power. Now, and he loved people like Pierce or James Connolly, who was a socialist and a union man. So I got a lot of information from my father, who was very political. So here I am, you know, I'm writing a book now about the Irish independence, because after going to Dublin for the centennial, I realized, I Googled up and started looking for books, and I realized nobody ever wrote one in Spanish about the Irish Revolution.
That actually leads me to a question, Sergio. How significant, I mean, you obviously speak fluent English. Is that common amongst Irish Argentinians in terms of maintaining that linguistic continuity? Could you give us a sense of that?
Yes. One thing you have to know is, okay, Argentina has about 40 million people in it, 40-something, and we are about maybe 600,000 people of Irish descent. So about one point something of the population. A small community, all in all. Then most of the Irish, most Irish Argentines, to this day, they live in small towns. they still farm the land. They hand down the land, the farms, from one generation to the other. Because, you know, I was wondering, where is all these people? I live in Buenos Aires, which is a city as big as New York, give or take, and I hardly ever run into people with Irish names. Hardly ever. So I remember years ago asking an Irish ambassador, and he said, oh, they're in the countryside. And he started telling me about all these towns that have 10%, 20%, 30% of the people living there have Irish names. And there is this amazing thing that you go there and you find kids who speak English with a very antiquated Irish accent.
Wow.
Which is, you know, isolated communities passing the language naturally. Like at home, you speak English. Outside, you speak Spanish. So you meet these young people who speak perfect Spanish. I mean, modern, actual, nowadays Spanish. But when they switch to English, they have these quaint, antiquated accents and expressions that I remember my grandfather using, you know. So, and it's also funny, every time we switch to English, 10 minutes into the conversation, somebody says, but you sound American. And I say, yep, well, sorry, you know. I moved to the States when I was young, and I got, you know, that accent. Oh, no, 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 you shouldn't do that. But you find that melody extant there. It's really amazing. And you find people, elderly people, that really speak like, I guess, James Joyce must have spoken English. That really old-fashioned English.
That's amazing.
By the way, Borges spoke like that. He learned English from his grandmother, who died in 1912, imagine. And he spoke Victorian English all his life. If you find a recording of Borges, you will hear this voice from the 19th century. Mm-hmm. Seeing yay yates. Mm-hmm. You would say these strange vowel games. So there is English. Now, of course, many, many, many Irish Argentines don't speak English. All they learn it at school.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing is, you know, if you marry and you're going to speak English to your kids, you need the mother's consent, right? So, unless you marry Irish, which is difficult, we are only 1% of the population. So there is that too. And many people really, I don't know, they don't take the bother to speak a foreign language at home anymore.
Sergio, can you tell us about, so Michael Kiernan leaves in the 1860s. He doesn't ever return to Ireland, is
no.
That correct? Who's the first of that line of Kiernans to return to Ireland, and can you tell us just a little bit about that?
I can tell you only a little bit of that, because the one who go back was one of my grandfather's brothers, Patrick Kiernan, one of those who never married. He loved to travel. He, you know, a man back in the day, it was very unusual for people to travel abroad, but Patrick even went to China.
Yeah,
it was very special. And eventually, in the late 20s, he goes to Ireland and comes back by ship. I mean, it took weeks and weeks. Comes back, and there's a family dinner.
And he would have been... His father was the one who had left Ireland, right? He's
right.
Only one generation removed.
This is first generation. And since they were born and raised in a farm, actually they were more at ease in English than in Spanish. All the brothers and sisters spoke Spanish very well, but still English was their language.
Okay.
So they were born in Argentina, but they were really Irish. I mean, genetically, they were 100% Irish, and culturally, they were farmers from an, you know, isolated community that mostly spoke English. So, Patrick goes to Ireland, He's very well received there. Imagine a man called Patrick Kiernan landing in Dublin, and, you know, with an Argentine passport. Nobody cared for the passport. You were Irish. He spends there a few weeks, comes back. Now, Patrick was a man of very few words. He was famously silent. So when he arrives back in Buenos Aires, they give him a welcome dinner, and then comes the question, okay, tell us about your country. Tell us about Ireland. And he says, oh, it was just like Dad used to say, you know, very green, nice. Oh, they're doing good, independence. And he looked around and said, but we are better off here, don't worry. And that was it.
Wow.
Over years later, he would tell an anecdote here, remember that something he saw in Ireland, but that was the full length of his report. Well, we are better off here.
Well, what an endorsement of what his father had done the generation prior.
Totally. Then my grandfather went back to Ireland in the 60s, and then me. In 1998 was my first trip to Ireland.
Wow.
But that's it, you know.
And have you brought your children there, Sergio?
Not yet, but I will, because, you know, my children were very much educated since they were very young to know that they are Irish.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, okay, we are Irish. Oh, but Mom, and this, I know, I'm not counting, you know, genes or blood or anything like that. Don't be silly. We're Irish. Your name is Kiernan. They all have Irish names. You know, my eldest is Liam Kiernan, then I have a daughter, Erin Kiernan, and then the young one you just met, Rebecca Ann, in honor of my great grandmother.
Wow.
So, okay, so get real here. I don't know how you feel about that, but this is your tradition. I'm passing it down. Then you do whatever you want. But they are coming around. They are getting interested. My eldest daughter, Erin, she plays tennis, and she tends to wear a hoodie that reads Ireland when she wins.
Oh, it's good.
Like, okay. So I think they like it.
Yeah, and they'll enjoy it when you bring them there. Mm. Well, listen, Sergio, thank you so much for sharing with me some of your family background and some of your amazing insights into the Irish experience in Argentina. So you're working on a book on this topic?
I'm working on a book on the rebellion and the War of Independence.
Wonderful.
So there is one in Spanish, not a translation, because I found a translation. The problem with that is that if you have a book in English, if you have an Irish book on that, it assumes knowledge of Irish history and Irish reality that I cannot assume if I write in Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
I have to start from scratch. I mean, like the Normans coming into Ireland to explain the context of the revolution and the War of Independence. So I'll finish it this year and see if I can get it published before 1922.
Wonderful.
So we can mark one of the centennials coming now.
Yeah, that's great. Well, listen, Sergio, welcome again, and I hope this is the first of many visits. I know you come to New York from time to time, and please don't be a stranger. The kettle's always on downstairs and things like that, so I hope
you.
We'll see you again, and we will continue conversations about possible collaborations and things in the future. Thank you, Sergio.
Thank you very much.
I'm delighted to welcome to This Irish American Life Bridget Bray. Bridget is someone who is thankfully no stranger to us here on our radio hour. Welcome back, Bridget.
Thank you very much. I appreciate being on here.
Not at all. It's our pleasure to have a chat to you. The last time we were talking to you was the fall of last year about your genealogy exploits, and I'm happy to say that that's what we're picking up the conversation on again here in 2019. You're keeping busy with the new year, our new and our spring season. tell us, Bridget, what you have in store coming up, I believe, on March 2nd.
Yeah, so on March 2nd, as you say, it's sort of an extension of the genealogy theme, but with a slightly different format, and it's called Genealogy Potluck. And the premise behind it is, as we all know, the traditional notion of a potluck is everyone brings a dish. Well, this is sort of a spin on it, where you can bring yourself, or you can bring an idea or content around genealogy or DNA that you'd like to share. So across the day, that's what will unfold, is that it's in part content that I'll be delivering, but also in part from the community of genealogy enthusiasts that'll be joining there.
Okay, so how does that look exactly to the uninitiated, Bridget, in terms of what would our listeners be, thinking about today in terms of engaging with their genealogy or their family background, and how that would work in the context of what you've planned with this potluck?
Yeah, so the event is structured where it'll still open, or it will open, with an overview on how to get started on genealogy. And I think that's always a good base, because there is often elements that even those that are more initiated into genealogy can take away with regards to reminders or refreshers. And so that sets the tone for the event. But also, as each guest comes to join the genealogy potluck, they will be invited to share, you know, topics of interest that they are particularly looking to potentially extend on. And we'll, there'll be that fluidity within the event itself. Because the idea is, a lot of events, including events that I've held as well, you know, you have a roster of speakers and experts that talk on a number of topics, and sometimes there's a window of questions that can be posed. Well, this is going to dive a little bit deeper. It's going to be really a conversational, a discussional type of format, where while there may be content and information shared on a number of different topics, it's also inviting those that will be within the space to say, listen, you know, what else have you learned? Have you tried this? What has sort of been your takeaway? So it's a little bit more interactive, mm-hmm. and it'll dive into a number of different topics.
Okay. So, really then, it's, by the sounds of it then, Bridget, it's open to kind of all levels, as it were, in terms of people's engagement with genealogy, from maybe novices, people who are kind of dipping their toe in, and then people who've a little bit more experience. Am I correct in thinking that?
Yeah, and I always think that in any kind of forum, that really is generally sort of the breadth that you want to adopt, because even someone who is very seasoned may have, you know, advice or input to share, but also may have something reinforced or a different sort of strategy or idea that they've not thought on it before. And, you know, one of the subjects that a member of the community and a member of the Irish-British genealogy group, in fact, will be delivering is focused on cybersecurity. And when you think about it, whether you're getting started or you've spent a lot of time doing research, you know, to think on some of the steps that you should undertake to preserve and protect your information and that of your family has a bearing regardless of where you are in your stage of research.
Yeah, funnily enough, Bridget, I was just talking to some of my students about that the other day in terms of oral histories. As you know, it's something that is near and dear to my heart. And, you know, we were just discussing the fact that in making certain content of oral histories available, how careful we need to be in this current era in terms of making certain aspects of our family history maybe available. You know, historically, we would do things like, you know, ask security questions, what's your mother's maiden name and things like that. And you have to be kind of careful about what kind of information is out there. And I suppose the same applies with these online databases in terms of people mapping DNA and things like that.
Yeah, because one of the elements that actually came out in the event in the fall, which was a very poignant message to deliver, is that, you know, even if you're undertaking DNA research for yourself, you're actually sharing your connected DNA family that you are, you know, doing that test for. In other words, they may not be explicitly taking that DNA test themselves, but inherently through you submitting your DNA, you are connecting them to others within that database. And there's so many other components. And so this is one of those topics that will be, you know, dived into and given an opportunity for those to sort of share as well. what they're doing or what they may be not doing in their quest to uncover their family history.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. My father recently did a DNA test himself, and he did it through Ancestry.com just randomly. We purchased the kit from mm-hmm. that particular company, and as soon as his results were in, he got an email from someone saying, you know, we were genetically related and stuff like that, and we were just, you know, talking about that, about how these things now can happen in terms of connections and the implications, positive and negative, in terms of how we connect to people and what kind of information is out there and things like that. It's, an emerging field in terms of discussion, really, Bridget.
Yeah, and I think it's a heightened awareness. You know, when you talk about Ancestry and 23andMe in particular, I mean, they're placing a lot of ads, so you're seeing it on the TV, so those that may not even be into genealogy, but they see those ads and they're curious about their, you know, cultural breakdown, they'll take these tests because they're curious to know, you know, what percentage am I on this or that. But there's, as you say, there's the bigger part of it, which is, well, it might uncover something that you're not expecting. It may connect you with someone that you hadn't planned to, or your family hadn't planned to, or someone within your family connection is not aware that you're doing that test. So as I said, it's all the kind of elements to consider. I don't think it will necessarily prevent anyone who's passionate about building their family tree to stop, but they may take pause on the type of information that they're sharing on genealogy as well as DNA sites, and just being mindful of that, right, while still, you know, pursuing their quest to make more connections and find out more about their ancestry.
The event is on at the New York Irish Center in Long Island City from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m., I see, Bridget. Is it exclusively an event for people interested in Irish genealogy, or presumably just by definition you would be attracting people in who are of mixed heritage, right?
Yeah, I mean, there will be obviously a layer that will have an Irish component to it, but, you know, I always say that it's generally very universal, and especially when we go into some of the topics, yes, it happens to be that maybe the individual that's being highlighted as part of a case study happens to be of Irish origin or Irish ancestry, but the steps that you undertake have relevance to anyone in that room. You know, and then when you talk about, say, the records that are available in New York, well, that has no bearing on what cultural background you may come from, because, again, it goes back to what are the resources that you're going to, what are the steps that you're undertaking. And as I said, some of those will have an Irish leaning to it, but anyone is welcome to join, because I think there will definitely be takeaways and discussion points. And as we all know, not all of us are 100% of one particular cultural dynamic, so we are looking at different channels to consider.
Mm-hmm. And the great location, I was just there at the New York Irish Center. A shout out to Paul Finnegan and to Jane mm-hmm. MacArthur O'Dowd and everyone out there who does such a great job in running such a great resource for the Irish American community and that kind of local catchment area there, just on the cusp of Manhattan and stretching out into Queens. It's a really great location. I'm sure you're really happy to be hosting it there, Bridget.
Yeah, and actually that's what, you know, given the vibe and the context that I wanted to create around this event, it is very much a community portal and a draw, and having that setting I think is very conducive to this genealogy potluck. And moreover, it twins with the fact that, in fact, it's the 10th anniversary, just a few days after that, of the Irish and British Genealogy Group that I've been running locally, in which I've actually conducted How to Get Started genealogy sessions at the New York Irish Center. So all told, it was and is a great fit for it, and a great team to work with to make it happen.
I absolutely agree with you. Now, not resting on your laurels, and I suppose harnessing on the immense interest in things Irish in March. Tell us what you have in store for March 9th, Bridget, if you wouldn't mind.
Yeah, so just a week later, this will be an event. It's called Fair Plate, and it centers on telling the story of the Ireland food, drink, and craft aspects. And it's really about, you know, providing a showcase, providing an opportunity and a platform to highlight what the real Ireland is bringing to the table. You know, there's often a lot of misconceptions or not even perceptions that are fully understood around what Ireland does offer in that regard. And so this is an event that'll take place across Saturday afternoon, and within the space at the Rag Trader will be a selection of brands that are of Irish origin, and they will be there to, you know, share their story. And in many cases, there's actually the founders or the owners of the brands that will be there, or there'll be brand ambassadors that can impart that aspect of their brand as well.
Yeah, because Ireland gets a bad reputation, I think, in terms of historically what we had in offer in the gastronomic field and maybe in comparison to some of the other European migrants. I'm thinking of our Italian cousins who boast this really, you know, high profile in terms of food, Irish food and all these, you know, beers and all these different types of things that we can consume are really kind of up there at the international level now in a way that sometimes people don't really realize. I think that reputation of it being a place that, you know, maybe you can only get a good potato or something like that, that's kind of gone out the window.
Yeah, and I also would say, like, you know, I think back to many years back where, you know, had I been posed the question on what Irish food and drink meant, I'm not sure what my answer would have been, but it certainly wouldn't have been anywhere close to the knowledge that I have now. And what struck me, I mean, I've been visiting Ireland and going there for years now, but it was in the last 10 years or so, in fact, on the back of doing genealogy research, that I remember it was this one particular experience where, you know, what was placed ahead of me or before me was not the most, you know, absolutely, you know, what would I say, highly customized dish. It was the ingredients that were so evident that the quality that stood out from them, you know, really opened my eyes. And that was sort of the trigger to say, hey, I need to really explore this Irish food and drink story to a greater degree. And that's what started, you know, finding out more about what was going on, what were the brands, the artisans, the crafts that were in this space. And, you know, coming back to New York and sort of looking out on the market here, you know, there was a lot of events that were catering to different aspects of the Irish community, whether it was dance or music or poetry, but it seemed pretty silent on food and drink. And, you know, a lot of what you would see there might be, say, the green beer or the corned beef and cabbage. Those are not things that I've ever seen, you know, in Ireland, right? So that sort of was the trigger of saying, well, what if something was to happen here locally, and see if there might be an interest of others who either are aware or are curious to know more about this aspect of food and drink from Ireland.
And how do you find, I think this is your fourth year into this, Bridget, mm-hmm. what has struck you the most in terms of how people engage with Irish products in that regard, or what surprises them when they, you know, encounter Fair Plate?
Well, I think, you know, I've heard, you know, these would be sort of little excerpts of conversations, if you will. I mean, I've had anything from, wow, it's great to see something that puts, you know, the Ireland that I know, say someone who's originally from Ireland who's here, but it's also been equally refreshing and rewarding to hear from individuals who have had little to no exposure to Irish food and drink, and for them to comment, you know, words such as, wow, the quality, or I didn't know this aspect about this. And, you know, what comes to mind, I was in conversation, I remember last year, with a blogger who had come to the event, and the blogger focused on wellness nutrition and, you know, not within or knowledgeable really about the Irish community, but had come to this event to check it out. And the conversation ensued where it was this eye-opening awareness that had been created by coming there, by just hearing and knowing about the products and the steps that they undergo and the accreditation or recognition under the auspices of the Irish Food Board and their, you know, Origin Green program. And so this was an eye-opener for this particular blogger. And all those bits and pieces really, I think, help sort of validate that, you know, this is an opportunity to showcase that. And then you start to look at some of the initiatives that are now taking place on the market, whether it's the launch of food tours in Ireland or increased food festivals that are happening in Ireland. I mean, that's saying something. It's saying that people are becoming, you know, a little bit more aware of the fact that Ireland has so many things to offer, and that includes food and drink.
Yeah, I have to say, Bridget, it gives me much pleasure. I know this is probably a crude assessment of it, but I've watched incrementally the availability of, to name one brand, very related to Ireland. And indeed, as a historian, I'm very conscious of the history of the export of Irish butter over centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And a few years ago, you know, one had to go to an Irish store to buy, for example, Kerrygold butter. And it's just been remarkable in the last couple of years to see now, you know, and some of it speaks to like globalization and things like that, but immense penetration of markets where I think, you know, almost every supermarket in New York and Brooklyn, at least in my experience, you can now get Irish butter and at a comparable price to possibly what you would pay for it in Ireland. It's amazing to see mm-hmm. how that kind of, you know, I guess, work that's been done in terms of raising the visibility of just at least one example of a very Irish product.
But a very successful one.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know,
yeah.
I think the last time I picked up, and I think this is sort of what they've maintained, is that they are the number two butter here in America. I mean, that's a phenomenal story. And, you know, I think in when you start to think about a lot of the different, you know, food and drink products that come from Ireland, you know, they stand on their own merit about the quality of the taste and, you know, the product itself. Oh, and it happens to be Irish, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that's where you start to see the brands elevate, and that it comes through awareness, it comes through tasting, it comes through experiencing, it comes to learning more about the respective story. And, you know, that I think is one of the elements of what Fair Plate brings to life, is that you can connect directly and hear more versus when, say, you're walking in a grocery store and you have this myriad of choices of which to make on one particular category of food, say. You know, are you going to go for the one that's the lowest price? Is it the one about awareness? Is it the packaging? You know, once you start to know a little bit more about what you see, you can make, you know, more educated choices, and you can say, well, actually, I know this is the taste profile that I prefer,
mm-hmm.
and whatever that ended up being, you know, that might be the direction you go. And I think this is one way to sort of elevate that visibility.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more. Listen, Bridget, thank you for sharing that information with us. Genealogy potluck at the New York Irish Center, Long Island City, from 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. on March 2nd. And then the following Saturday, March 9th, Fair Plate, a celebration of Irish food and drink from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. at the Rag Trader. Bridget, please be back on to us again soon. You always have some really interesting and innovative topics to talk about with us, and we're delighted to have had a chance to talk to you here on this Irish American Life. Best of luck with the events, and we hope to see you again soon.
And thank you. I've been equally delighted to have the opportunity to have our conversation, so appreciate it.
Thanks, Bridget.
Thank you.
We're coming towards the end of the program. I'm Dr. Miriam Nighan-Gray, and I want to thank you for listening to This Irish American Life, coming to you from NYU Center for Irish and Irish American Studies, Luxman, Ireland House. You can tune in to us on Saturdays on WNYE 91.5 FM in the tri-state area and worldwide on www.nyuirish.net/radiohour, as well as on irishradio.com. We come to you every week in collaboration with Irish Radio Network USA. Thanks for tuning in, folks. Have a lovely weekend. Slán agus beannacht. Our theme music today is The Opening Set by The Gloaming, produced by Brassland and Real World Records.